Iran sees an uptick in street demonstrations fueled by worker grievances. We'll hear from the group Human Rights Activists in Iran about another factor driving protests in recent days.
We see these three individuals executed for these protest-related charges, and we see this outrage. But what's unique right now is we're seeing it inside of the country.
Plus, the reporter behind the podcast London Grad tells us what he learned about the British response to Iran's alleged attempts to kidnap or kill its critics on British soil.
So on the really big question about Britain's stance on Iran, I feel that's still shrouded in secrecy completely.
And later in the program, Pakistan's plan to open cross-border markets with Iran inspires hope and skepticism. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Iran. Good morning. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. There was more protest activity in Iran on Tuesday, with VOA's Persian service observing reports of labor-related demonstrations in the central provinces of Kerman and Yazd and the southern province of Bushehr. Among the grievances of the protesters were the raising of the retirement age and removal of government benefits. U.S.-based nonprofit group Human Rights Activists in Iran says it also has monitored protests triggered by Tehran's May 19th execution of three men arrested for involvement in last year's nationwide protests against Iran's Islamist rulers. They were among at least 242 people whom Iran has executed so far this year, according to the group also known as Harana. Skylar Thompson is Harana's Director of Global Advocacy. I asked her on the phone what kinds of protests the executions have sparked in Iran.
So there has been a really unprecedented protest activity inside Iran against the surge in executions. But I think it's really important to point out these three individuals that were executed were not unlike other cases we've seen in the past. I was speaking to a colleague last week about an analysis we did in February of 2022 about a surge in executions in Iran, and we're calling on the international community to really take a look at this and to really speak out against the surge in executions that we were seeing. And, you know, we saw really intense pressure on Iran at that time, and it sort of wavered. And here we are again talking about a surge in executions, many of them for drug-related crimes. And then we see these three individuals executed for these protest-related charges, and we see this outrage. But what's unique right now is we're seeing it inside of the country. We're seeing families of those sentenced to death demonstrating in front of courts and prisons. Political prisoners and prominent figures have also issued statements demanding a halt to executions. And even abroad, we're seeing protests that have been staged in various countries. You know, we saw it in DC and elsewhere in Europe. So I think it's something that people are really, you know, saying time is up on. And what we would like to see outside of that is, you know, really concrete measures to say there has to be accountability for this complete disregard to the right to life. It's just what we were speaking of before. There's no due process to really say that any of these sentences are even valid. So it's really concerning.
With all the anger that you've seen in Iran in response to these executions, why hasn't that brought even more protesters out to the streets on the scale that we saw late last year?
I think it's a really good question. I think there are many different analyses that take place in this regard, but what's really critical to note is that people's demands remain unaddressed and societal changes experienced following the protests indicate that these demands will resurface in the street protests if not addressed. And what we're seeing now is these proposed bills on restricting people's expression even further. We see these facial recognition softwares being put in place. We see bills in parliament being proposed to enforce these compulsory hijab laws even further. We see small businesses being shut because people are providing services to women who are not wearing the hijab in the way that they should be in the eyes of the regime. So I think it's clear that people's demands were not met And so I think we can expect to see some sort of return to this in the future.
Another development that your group Harana has been reporting on is a series of lawyers in Iran being interrogated and prosecuted in recent weeks for defending dissidents and protesters. How is this affecting the ability of Iranians to have access to proper legal representation?
So we've been watching this extremely closely. I think, you know, it's really an indication of the atmosphere in the country right now. We released a report last week that was indicating that at least 129 lawyers had been summoned, and prosecution of lawyers is, of course, negatively impacting the ability of political prisoners and dissidents to exercise their rights. They are feeling threatened. And I think what's really a shame is that these lawyers are less inclined to defend their clients when they're feeling at risk themselves. This is not, of course, all of them, but it's, of course, the case. And at times, they're also thinking of their families. And you can't fault anyone for this. Many summoned lawyers have been coerced into signing affidavits that restrict their commentary in the media space. And this also further limits their capacity to advocate for their clients or defend clients taking on new cases at all. It's been something that we've seen time and time again. And I think this has to be watched with a very close eye. And we would really hope that particularly the international community would watch this. I mean, I think the common thread here is that it's not simply a crackdown on, you know, people in the streets, and we saw people detained, and, you know, we're just following up on reports of this. You noted that why haven't people returned to the streets? And we're now seeing journalists that reported on those protests at trial. We're seeing lawyers that defended people detained being summoned and coerced into signing papers that they can't defend their clients. It's an attack on society writ large. And I think it's something that people are quite frightened about.
Well, Skylar Thompson, Director of Global Advocacy and Accountability at Human Rights Activists in Iran, speaking to us from here in Washington, D.C. Thank you very much for coming on to Flashpoint Iran.
Thanks, Michael.
Escalating security threats to Iranian journalists and dissidents in Britain that British authorities say emanate from Iran are the focus of the second season of the podcast London Grad, which was released this month. Season 2 of the podcast by London-based investigative reporter Paul Caruana Galizia of Tortoise Media reveals some previously unreported details about Iran's alleged plots to kidnap or kill the journalists and other perceived critics and enemies of the Islamic Republic on British territory. Iran has repeatedly denied accusations from Western governments that it has sent its agents and proxies to their nations to carry out violent operations. Caruana Galizia ended the last episode of London Grad Season 2 by reviewing the questions that he initially sought to answer about those alleged plots. In part 1 of my phone interview with him, I asked whether he got the answers he was looking for.
I would say there are a lot of unresolved questions, and as always in investigations like these, you sort of raise as many questions as you answer. So on the really big question about Britain's stance on Iran, I feel that's still shrouded in secrecy completely. It's not clear to me why the UK Foreign Office isn't more direct, more frank in its assessments of Iran and what kind of relationship it wants with the country. On the individual plots, while we were able to uncover trends and patterns, and in a couple of cases, actual identities of agents and their commissioners, there are so many more plots where we just don't have that information, which I find extraordinary, that, you know, there are really serious crimes that no one's been held to account for them. No one, no organization. Nothing.
And what is your view as to why there's no information about the many plots that you've uncovered?
I think in the UK, there is something specific about the architecture of its security service and secret intelligence service. And compared to the US, certainly they're much more opaque. They release very little information. They don't have much of a public face, although that is changing increasingly, in large part because Iran has become so aggressive. So there is that. And then there is another issue, again, when it comes to the UK, that the way its national security laws are drafted makes it quite hard to prosecute a lot of these crimes. So investigators rarely ever acquire enough evidence to meet the standard of a criminal court. But above all, our sense from the podcast is that there's an overriding issue, and it's one of political will. So there were many cases, actually, where that evidentiary threshold must have been met, yet no action was taken. So one thing we did is go back in time to 1979 and look at plots since the Islamic Revolution. And you'll find in the newspaper archives some really serious plots, you know, attempted bombings, ones that went badly, where you'd have names of operatives and their targets. Yet, even then, there was no resulting prosecution. They never went anywhere near a courtroom. And they most often resulted in deportations under the Prevention of Terrorism Act. And that is ultimately a policy decision. That is a minister somewhere saying, let's just deport. And across all these plots, none of those decision makers have answered a very simple question. Why? Why are you choosing to deport rather than prosecute?
And what is your best guess as to the reason for that?
So we spoke to a number of people who you would have heard on the podcast, so former MI6 officers, a former ambassador in Tehran. But then we also spoke to a lot of people on background, as you'd expect in a project like this, so who work in national security in the UK and in the US. And as one former CIA officer told me, one who's worked on Iran for many years, ultimately, the best we can do, by which he meant national security professionals, is brief ministers and then leave the room. And at that point, the assessment changes, and the questions you ask as a minister might be, is it worth it? Is it worth upsetting relations with Iran to prosecute a plot, an attempted kidnapping, say? Is it really worth it? And is there something else we can do? Can it be resolved in another way? And I think those are the questions and issues that come into play.
Well, what I'd love to hear from you is what kind of responses you've had to this podcast from the Iranian journalists in London who have been under perhaps the greatest threat recently from, you know, alleged Iranian plots and even from other members of the Iranian diaspora.
The response from them has been positive. So a lot of them wrote to me to say how relieved they feel that someone is covering this story and exposing it in a direct way, you know, naming people, questioning people, and so on. So there's this sense that it's, at least in a small way, been brought out into the light. So a lot of the Iranian journalists in London have, of course, been living with these kinds of threats for a while. They've intensified only very recently. But over the whole period, they've been advised not to speak up about the threats or the precautions they take, which is a more obvious thing. But for them, it's completely paralyzing. You know, it affects your professional life, your social life, your family. It affects your life in total. And of course, there are advantages to sort of being discreet and pretending you've been unaffected by it. But at a certain point, the balance tips, I think. And that really happened here. I think it gets to a point where you have to send a signal that this is really not something that should be tolerated. It's really not something that should be kept hidden. And it's something that needs to end.
That was investigative reporter Paul Caruana Galizia. Join me next week for part two of my conversation with the London grad podcast producer, who tells me whether he faced any risks by trying to expose the murky world of alleged Iranian plots in Britain. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Iran. I'm Michael Lippin. Iran and its neighbor Pakistan celebrated a rare achievement on May 18th, with their leaders meeting along their shared border to inaugurate a joint marketplace and a power line providing Pakistanis with low-cost Iranian electricity. The meeting of Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi and Pakistani Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif took place at a border post connecting the Iranian town of Pishin and Mand in Pakistan. 3 days later, there was a reminder of their long-running cross-border tensions when Iran said terrorists operating from Pakistan killed six Iranian security personnel near the border. Ayaz Ghul is a VOA correspondent in the Pakistani capital, Islamabad. I asked him in a phone call why Pakistan is seeking closer economic ties with Iran.
Well, that's an interesting question because the relationship between Iran and Pakistan has been a strange sort of relationship because, you know, both the countries share similarities like religion, culture, and then they share more than 900 kilometers of border. So in terms of this proximity and cultural similarities, religious similarities, they should have had great relationship over the years, but they have not been able to really expand in terms of political ties and trade ties, economic ties, because the divergences on the worldview, Iran has a totally different approach and Pakistan has a different approach. And that is why they really have not been able to develop this relationship into something big because of the proximity and closeness. They should have been having great trade ties. And right now, the two countries have like less than $2 billion annual trade, which is nothing in terms of the volume that should have been there because it's a large country, Iran and Pakistan.
So can you explain what are those different worldviews that have kept Iran and Pakistan from having closer relations?
Well, number one, obviously, is that Pakistan has always been close to the United States, from its creation in 1947. And number two is that Saudi Arabia has been a very close ally of Pakistan. It has always helped Pakistan in terms of providing oil on deferred payments and, providing other financial support, deposits to support its foreign exchange reserves. So, and secondly, Pakistan is a majority Sunni country. Shiites are like 15 or 20%. So the relationship with Saudi Arabia and closeness with the United States has always been a problem for Iran, which is predominantly Shiite country. And so Iran and United States have had quite a difficult relationship, always full of tensions and problems, whereas Pakistan has always tried to keep Saudi Arabia and the United States happy in terms of, foreign policy issues. And that's where the mistrust or suspicion, comes in between the relationship of Pakistan and Iran. So that is really creating a big challenge for Pakistan because Pakistan's largest province in terms of area is Balochistan. And that is the province which shares the entire 900-kilometer border with Iran. And that province is a natural resources-rich province, but it is impoverished. And Pakistan has always tried to bring development there. But then this province has been experiencing a low-level separatist insurgency. And repeatedly, Pakistan has been accusing Iran of giving shelter to leaders of these insurgent groups.
So can I ask you, when it comes to these economic projects that were inaugurated by the leaders of the two countries in the middle of May, how much of a challenge do these projects face when you consider the insecurity that you mentioned?
Well, I was about to tell you that this is a significant development. It's a milestone, one can call it, because ever since China has broken this deal between Saudi Arabia and Iran to bring them close, and they have sort of moved towards normalizing their relationship, it has become a challenge for Pakistan also, because Pakistan has a very close relationship with China. I mean, it's a lot of investment here, economic investment and military ties. So with Saudi Arabia and Iran coming closer, it has become a challenge for Pakistan how to deal with this situation, because Pakistan can no longer stay away from Iran just to keep the Western allies happy. So I think this inauguration, the primary objective, what we understand from our discussions with officials here, is that because this province, Balochistan, is a sparsely populated province of Pakistan, and this remote border region, there are thousands of families living on this side of the border and on the Iranian side of the border, but these are really poverty-stricken regions. So the basic idea is to create like 6 border markets and to generate some sort of retail market activity in these far-flung areas, so that families there can have some kind of economic opportunities, jobs. And secondly, it's important to know that for the first time, Pakistan has been able to fence most of the border with Iran. Only like maybe a year ago, Pakistan completed almost 90% of the fencing project. And this way, I think the objective on this side is to deter any militant activity and encourage population to become or supportive of the security operations that Pakistan has been conducting there, rather than leaving these empty areas. And, you know, for years, we have seen that militants have used these areas back and forth without fencing. They were able to move freely. So I think one of the concerns was how to address the security. And I think it's a small step if you look at the size of the two countries. But this is the first time that we have seen that the two countries have come close to at least inaugurate a joint project, despite all these years of suspicions and mistrust.
So how optimistic are people in Pakistan about the potential for significantly increasing trade with Iran through, you know, these recent projects and perhaps other ones, when you consider that the militancy is ongoing and you even have a lot of black market and smuggling activity that has existed in the Iranian-Pakistani border region for so long?
Yes, there is optimism. People are, definitely looking forward, especially traders here in Pakistan, that they may have an increased trade with Iran. But the issue is that Iran is under U.S. sanctions. So dealing with Iran in the energy sector, it's the petroleum products, you know, that Pakistan is keen to import. Most of it currently is being smuggled into Pakistan from Iran, and it is helping somehow Pakistan. But that obviously is a covert activity. And in return, you know, through the smuggling, Iran has been able to collect dollars from the Pakistani market. The trade in oil is being conducted in local currency, but the traders who are helping Iran, they are able to collect dollars from this market, and through Hundi and Hawala, it's being sent back to Iran. So this is how Iran has been able to gain from this smuggling activity. But now, obviously, with regular trade, the question is whether these 6 points that they plan to open on the border, whether they will be used for regular trade like vegetables and fruit and other stuff, or actually it is meant to facilitate the smuggling activity further. I mean, this is a big question, because, you know, otherwise it makes no sense. Previously, it was difficult, but now with having 5 or 6 regular routes for moving in and moving out with properly secured areas, what we are expecting is more smuggling through regular channels rather than any trade that would benefit the local people there. And I mean, there's optimism about all these activities, the way they are now inaugurated. It's good. But if you look on the ground, things are very challenging, and they're going to be more challenging in the months to come.
VOA reporter Ayaz Gul speaking to us from Islamabad. Great to have you on Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you. My pleasure.
That's all for this week's show. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Glad you were listening, and I invite you to do the same next week for another Flashpoint Iran.